Cheer up, man. You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on, son, cheer up.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on.
Nothing will come from nothing, you know what I say?
Cheer up, you old bugger.
Come on, give us a grin. There you are. See? In the film. Incidentally, this record's available in the foyer.
Always look on the right.
Someone's got to live as well,
you know?
What do you think pays for this rubbish?
Always look on the money back, you know?
I told him. I said to him. Bernie, I said, I'll never make that money back.
Gentlemen, welcome to the main event. Let's get ready to rumble!
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station.
And we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. You want to go up to our new depository for all kinds of our TV shows and all kinds of video, you just go on up there to Tom Metzger or to the archives, tommetzgerarchives.com. Yeah, you just started filling that up, so don't get excited if you only see a few Race and Reason shows up there. Of course, you can go to Tom Metzger Race and Reason. You can go up there too, and on YouTube, and there's a whole bunch of them up there, but there's also some negative ones up there. Well, that's all right. We can stand it. Well, how great does it feel for this day after the Martin Luther King's birthday, man? Oh, I celebrated it like mad. Only I celebrated James Earl Ray Day, man. We had a good time. A lot of guys around that old terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern with a headache this morning and a hangover, I'll tell you that. Thank you, Martin Luther King, for giving us a holiday where we can celebrate your assassin. How about that? Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Well, I see old Donald Trump, they tried to get him banned from Britain. Well, don't feel bad. There's been lots of people that have been banned from Britain, including me. I know David Duke's been banned, at least he used to be, so it's no big deal to get banned from Britain because... and then one of the persons on the Labour Party was on TV this morning telling how horrible Trump was, and... you know, Britain didn't want him over there. Well, she's a non-white wog who's only been in the country probably a few years. And she's saying she's a Briton. She's a Brit. Hey, you're not a Brit if you're not white. That's my position. Especially Britain. Yeah. Just like you're not a German unless you're a white. And that's my decree. And if somebody doesn't like that, well, they can, you know what I always say about kissing. I think it's interesting that the Tea Party chose this last weekend to have their big blowout. They said they had over 1,000 people down there, and everybody that was anybody was down there speaking, and a lot of the candidates, too. So anyhow, that was interesting that they chose Martin Luther King's birthday. Does that show a... Pardon me, man, I'm telling you, I couldn't reach the kill button fast enough for that one. Well, it is, what is it, January the 19th, 2016, and it's another cold one here. It was down zero last night, and nobody around here stuck their nose out very much, I'll tell you. It's going to be great tomorrow because it's supposed to get up to 23 degrees. Oh, boy. I guess that's because of all that global warming's going on, man. Well, those dirty racists are on the move. This U.S. company just banned the Muslim prayer breaks. A Wisconsin company is telling Muslim employees they can no longer leave the assembly line to pray. I remember when Dennis Mahan was working out there at American Airlines in St. Louis, I believe it was, out there someplace. He said those Muslims used to take breaks and go out right on the tarmac and get out on their little rug and do their praying. Can you believe it? Because they had a whole bunch of these Muslims working for American Airlines on the airplanes. And he said they didn't know crap. They didn't do very good, but... imagine that. You probably had a Talibander working on the airplane. I'll tell you, I wouldn't want to fly American Airlines. In fact, I won't fly American Airlines. Well, I don't know how to take this one. This is in the religion section. The head of the Russian Orthodox Church has partially blamed an increase in acceptance of homosexuality for the rise of ISIS. Patriarch Kirill claimed he was not surprised that some Muslims are flocking to ISIS, quasi-religious state, in a way of escaping the godless civilization that celebrates events such as gay pride. In an interview published on the church's official website, Kirill said ISIS is creating a civilization that is new by comparison to the established one that is godless, secular, and even radical in its secularism. Quote, we can have parades for sexual minorities. That is supported, but a million French Christian protesters defending family values are broken up by the police, he added. Well, I have mixed emotions about that whole thing. But I don't believe that you can blame the rise of homosexuality on ISIS. You can blame a lot of things on ISIS, but I don't think that's one of them. Oh boy, here's another one. Just weeks before the Iowa caucus, GOP presidential contender Donald Trump is aiming his proudly political incorrect anger and his pledge to be great directly at evangelical Christians. Well, like all the rest of them on the Republican side. Quote, I'm going to protect Christians, unquote, who are losing their power in American society. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. The Christian churches are very powerful in this country. If you don't believe so, drive down any road and you'll see a Christian church on about every corner. And usually they're pretty well packed on Sunday and Thursday night and so forth. He was addressing 100,000 Liberty University students packed in at Lynchburg, Virginia, campus sports arena for viewing online. Trump, who was reared Presbyterian but has a freewheeling way of speaking of faith, cited Liberty as a place has lived up to the biblical passage in 2 Corinthians, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. And it goes on and on and on. This to me is very funny. Very funny that that Trump now is in bed with the evangelicals, like everything, with all the crazy people like Huckabee. Huckabee really pushes it. That's the guy who let the guy who was in prison, the nigger who was in prison for life, out because he thought he was okay now. And then the guy went out and killed another white woman. People seem to forget about that, you know. Yeah. I really like that Liberty University. Trump's the fourth contender to speak at the Liberty during his presidential election cycle, following in the footsteps of Republican contenders Senator Ted Cruz, Dr. Ben Black Carson, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, and Democratic contender Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders speaking at Liberty University, I think is pretty funny. I think that's really funny. Yeah, this is the campus where Jerry Falwell used to live before he went to see his maker. And as George Carlin would say, I wonder if he's up there looking down on us or he's down there looking up on us. I think he's down there looking up on us. Well, an ex-Vatican official is acquitted in a money smuggling case. How about that? Dateline Rome, a former Vatican prelate, was acquitted on Monday of conspiring to smuggle millions of euros in cash into Italy from Switzerland for rich friends. How about that? Monsignor Nunzio Scarano worked for 22 years as a senior accountant in the APSA, a Vatican department that handles real estate and stock investments for the Holy See. He was dismissed from his post after Italian magistrates charged him in June 2013 with plotting, along with the Italian Secret Service agent and a financial broker, to smuggle 20 million euros, that's about $21.8 million, into Italy. But he got kicked loose. And I wonder why. I wonder who all got the money. Well, here's some statements by black people about the Reverend Martin Luther King yesterday. Boy, and I'll tell you, they know what's going on. Listen to this.
Hi. I'm Adele Banks, National Reporter for Religion News Service. I'm here at the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial asking people what they think about Reverend King as a spiritual leader.
As a spiritual leader, I think he was a great man. He definitely allowed God to use him. He was chosen by God. A lot of times when we're chosen, we decide to run away from the calling, but Dr. King did not do that.
Oh, yeah, I ran away. Calling.
Well, I grew up and saw him as a child.
Oh, yeah.
During the civil rights struggle, and I see him as a prophetic religious leader. He had divine connection with God. We know that by actions that he took.
Oh.
And he had no fear in his heart.
I think that a lot of his message of hope and change back in the 1960s and when he was, you know, prevalent, people had to think about it as, you know, part of the past, but I think a lot of it applies to, you know, issues we have today.
As a spiritual leader, he always did what his heart told him to do, even though others felt
When did your heart tell you to do something?
Rise up against and fight. He remained
My heart's
healed,
never told me to do something
he
except
a lot of people
pump
together.
Blood.
He preached peace and love and... And
he's a white Aryan girl.
Those are the most important things, basically. So he led in a spiritual sense and in a political sense, but I think he mostly dedicated himself to being a good spiritual leader, just because that's what he started out at.
Yeah, okay. That wasn't God that chose him. That was James Earl Ray chose him. How about that? And he was very much alive. Just a sample of the insanity that goes on and on and on, 24 hours a day. It never quits. Every time I turn on the radio around here in Indiana, every other station's a Jesus station, and they're going at it preaching every day of the week, not just Sunday, or not just Saturday like the Jews. They're on every day of the week. They're hawking their wares. They have no idea how stupid they sound. They just don't. I'm going to play a little bit here, but this big shot Christian, he's on Voice of America, and he's telling what for, and you'll notice the similarities between what he's saying about ISIS and what fundamentalist Christians say. Wow.
In chief of the Religion News Service right here in Washington. Welcome back, Jerome, and congratulations on the new gig.
Thank you, Mel. It's good to be here. I wish the reason were less grim than it is.
Yeah, no, and so do I, because I know when you left, we lost a huge resource when it comes to these kinds of issues. But I guess, first of all, I want you to give us some sense of understanding on what really motivates ISIS. What is it? What is the driving force behind a group like Islamic State?
Well, a lot of experts agree that they are motivated by what we call an apocalyptic belief. In other words, they think the end of the world is coming. Now, the end of the world means, to apocalyptic believers, doesn't mean, you know, the earth blows up. It means there's a kind of change.
Now, isn't that exactly what the fundamentalist Christians believe? Come on, baby. Come on.
Change, a dramatic change.
So they believe we're in the end times already.
They believe that we're in the end times, and that's partly why what they are saying is so appealing. It's very seductive to young people, especially young Muslims around the world who feel they have no future in their countries, whose prospects are limited, to be part of this grand narrative,
right,
where they're going to be...
They're just joining up with the crazy Christians, really. They're radical, but all religions are radical, especially in the beginning. There wasn't much more radical religion in the world than Christianity. Millions of people were killed and slaughtered all over the world. And so under the badge of Christianity... George Bush went into Iraq, killed hundreds of thousands of people, and he mentioned that we're going in there with Jesus. Okay, let's see here. Let's hear some more of this.
Remembered almost as a scriptural figure for what they do.
So, Jerome, in the Islamic version of that apocalyptic state, what happens? I mean, how does the world turn out?
Well, it turns out that the world is reformed. Islam brings peace and it dominates the earth, really.
But how different really is that from the Christian version where the Christians say Jesus is going to come back to wipe out all of the evil forces and reign for a millennia?
Okay, I mean, it's a good question because Christianity, Judaism, Islam all have kind of messianic or these millenarian beliefs.
Crazy!
There are some secular beliefs, too, that are often cited as having apocalyptic beliefs, like the Nazis had it, or even Stalin and communists.
Oh, there we go again.
They dramatically changed the world and were willing to kill lots of people to
do it. Especially non-believers, obviously.
Especially non-believers, people who get in their way. Sometimes if people agree not to get in their way, that's okay. But... yeah, go ahead.
But as a bit of as a scholar and sort of a historian on these kinds of matters, is there no middle ground between all of these other religions and Islam? I mean, they essentially have similar prophecies, different outcomes,
right.
But similar prophecies. Correct?
So there are slight differences, or maybe more than slight differences, in the way the different religions see the end times. And there are differences within, very stark differences within Islam about how the end times come about. I spoke to one Islamic scholar who said, you know, that Muhammad prophesied difficult times, catastrophes before the end times or as part of the end times so that we avoid the end times, not so that we bring it on. I mean, all religions or most major religions have these ideas. I think the more important difference for an apocalyptic believer is how urgent they feel the end times are. One is how urgent. The other is, what is their role? What is the human's role? Because many people have apocalyptic beliefs, but feel it's that God will bring that on. They're you know, messianic Jews. There are many, many Christian apocalyptic believers who think that the end is near, but aren't going to do anything to bring it on.
And
Muslims, too. But here we have a group that wants to bring it on.
They want to bring it on. I guess what rankles many Christians is that for them, the end justifies the means, and they will use whatever means are necessary, including beheading, including burning reporters in steel cages. I mean, this is actually what we find so appalling, really.
Yeah, but you don't need a head in heaven if you're going directly to heaven. Most of these people are forgiven by ISIS. They chop their heads off. They go right to heaven. So what's the problem?
About that particular religious belief.
Right. I mean, it's hard, but we have to put our heads in the mind of these believers. To them, the world is corrupt and sinful beyond salvation. So they're willing to do anything to bring about this change.
Well, that may be true. It's sure corrupt, all right. It is very corrupt, and most of it is being brought on by religion and predatory capitalism. Follow the money, man, and follow the church money. Yeah, tax-free. You know, if you get rid of the tax-free program for the churches, you'd see these churches collapse like a cheap accordion with only a few believers left in them. Yeah.
Oh, I wish we had an extra hour to discuss some of these things. Very interesting stuff, and I hope we have you back again. Thank you, Jerome,
good
and
to be here,
Religion News Service for allowing you to come here.
Yeah, man, that was fascinating as a pile of donkey shit. One nut talking to another nut, and on it goes. Most of these Republicans that were in the forefront of wanting to occupy and kill and maim and torture people all over the Middle East declare themselves to be religious, and most of them say they're fundamentalists, even like George Bush. They never seem to take that into consideration. They just sort of leave that out of the scenario. And do you know of any Christian church that's promoting the idea of arresting George Bush Jr. and Cheney and taking them to The Hague and trying them as war criminals? Do you know any sizable Christian church that's doing that? Hell no. They're building statues to him. He's a wonderful, wonderful Christian man. Yeah. Well, he is a wonderful Christian man because that's what Christians do best. Now, you thought I only picked on the Christians and the Jews and the Muslims and like that. Well, I'm going to pick on the Buddhists now. This is Dateline Bangkok. Political divisions and allegations of corruption are fueling an unholy battle for the leadership of Buddhism. And I thought Buddhism was so peaceful. Religion is becoming a proxy war for the color-coded politics that Thailand's junta has squashed since taking power in 2014 in a bid to end a decade of political violence. Oh, does political violence have any origins in religion? Oh, no. The front runner for Supreme Patriarch, head of the country's 300,000 monks, is a 90-year-old abbot and Costello, no, not Costello, who is under investigation for a tax scam involving luxury cars. He has ties with the wealthy Dharmakaya temple, which is dogged by a scandal of its own, and which some devotees claim is a power base for the ousted former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra and his red-shirted supporters. Leading the campaign against him is a firebrand monk best known for his part in street protests backed by the loyalist military elite who reviled Thaksin and helped usher in the junta. Yeah. The pro-establishment cleric leading the charge against four front-runner Samjed Fra Maha Orachakamamawawa says that the military government must honor a pledge to stamp out corrupt practices that critics say were all allowed to flourish under the Thaksin for years, starting with the Supreme Buddhist Patriarch nominee. Wow. Hell, I thought we'd be safe being friends with the Buddhists, but they turned out to be just as bad as the rest of them. What the hell are we going to do? Well, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to do what George Carlin does and make fun of religion. And even Mike Malloy, who can't seem to stand racists or racial separatists, but he sure as hell knows how to attack religion. Well, I'm going to see if I can get out of the religion thing here, even though religious corruption is probably the most volatile corruption in the world today and has been for a long, long time, because religion's a cheap, you know, there's a reason why almost every black guy becomes a minister, because it gives him some power with no real credentials at all. Martin Luther King or any of these guys, they say, I'm speaking for God. They're not speaking for anybody except themselves, and then they get themselves a church, and every corner in the ghetto there's a little church, clapboard church, and the small-time crooks are bleeding the old black people in the black community and some of the young. I mean, it is a crime against humanity the way these preachers operate. Well, I think it's a good time for us to run a little story on Judeo-Christian predator drones that are much more precise and can wipe out more people. Here we go.
My name is Brandon Bryant. I'm a 27-year-old veteran. I was born here, born in Missoula. I was very much an introvert growing up, a single mother, two sisters, crap load of female cousins. So I was pretty much alone all the time. And I grew up with books and comic books and heroes and villains. I kind of grew up optimistic, idealistic. I grew up in a Christian home. I wasn't necessarily too patriotic. I was more of the fact of good guys versus bad guys, making decisions and doing the right thing. I decided to get into the Air Force because I was racking up college debt and I didn't know what else to do. So when I was talking to the Air Force recruiter, he's like, you know those guys that sit in the operations center for James Bond and gather the intelligence he needs to do his mission? And I was like, yeah, I know those guys, like Q and all them. And he's like, yeah, you'll be one of those guys. And I was like, it's pretty badass. Getting into the drone program was weird. The introduction is like, this is what we do. We kill people and break things. that is what our job is. I worried about it, you know, can I do this? Can I actually kill someone? Could I actually pull the trigger? I mean, I'm not actually pulling the trigger, I'm guiding the missile in, but it's essentially the same thing. I don't see a difference. We typically flew in Iraq between 8,000 and 12,000 feet. And then in Afghanistan, we flew between 18 and 25,000 feet. And depending on atmospherics, if it was a completely clear day, you would definitely get a good picture. And depending on how close you were, you could probably read the license plate on someone's car. We can see something as simple as people playing a soccer game. We can see individual players, and we can even see the ball.
Eight hour trip for the 16-year-old Tariq through treacherous terrain, through potential Taliban hotspots, and of course under drone surveillance.
It was the first time that the international media, the drone victims, the tribal elders, and the general public came together. It was held in a five-star hotel. The tribal elders spoke in terms of political implications, how they felt, and the drone victims spoke about personal stories.
The voice of the victims of drone attacks out to the general public as well as the rest of the world.
And that was the main goal. We were going to use the media to try and establish who had been killed and also why, where and how.
Well, because of the inaccessibility of Waziristan, it's very, very hard to compile any kind of credible evidence or evidence that other people will see as credible. That was part of the reason we organized this conference in Islamabad.
We called it a jirga.
A jirga is a traditional tribal gathering.
That's what people in that area use to settle their dispute.
Once the young boy, Tariq, concedes. When I was talking to Tariq, one of the first things that he did was he handed me his cousin's student ID card. And as I looked at it, I looked back at Tariq and I noticed that he was crying. He started to tell me the story of his cousin who had been killed from a drone strike. He'd come to the jirga primarily to inform us a little bit more about what had happened to his cousin, to people in his local village, and find out how to stop the killing. We sat together all day, we ate together at lunchtime, we laughed together, we became friends. Tariq was extremely intelligent and funny to be around. He had a nice sense of humour. He was fascinated by photography and intrigued by Western music, mentioning artists, and one that sprang to mind was Lady Gaga. He started to talk about drone strikes in his village, how he was unable to sleep at night. He was scared. He was worried about his family, his friends. Tariq was traumatized.
He wanted to talk about how he was affected by drone attacks and basically to give the message that the people of Waziristan want justice against the killings of innocent civilians under drone attacks that are operated by the U.S.
They adopted a resolution condemning the strikes. The outcome of the jirga was a big success because it allowed people to come together, listen to stories, and come to a common resolution. Then we went together to a rally, and Tariq Aziz traveled there with us.
We traveled towards the rally, and Tariq sat next to me. He seemed relaxed. He was laughing with his friends. Tariq and everybody else got out, and they went to the rally.
Drone attack in Pakistan.
Jo drones hain, ye Pakistan ke awam ki human rights.
Turned to their homes.
Sitting
A few days later, after I'd gone back to England,
I got an email.
I was at work when we found out.
We got an email and a telephone call. 4 days after the Jirga, I received an email from Shahzad. The email simply said Tariq as the heading, and I opened it instantly. To my shock, I found out that Tariq had been murdered by a drone strike.
And that was a shock. I mean, it was like, how is it possible? Where was he? What was he doing? And it's like completely unbelievable.
This wasn't happening. This was just a dream.
We didn't think that Tariq, the 16-year-old kid who wanted to talk about football, would be killed in a drone attack the same week that we'd met him.
Tariq killed.
If the U.S. had any information that Tariq Aziz was part of a criminal organization, was planning to carry out attacks on the United States, then our federal law enforcement agents should have been working with the authorities of Pakistan to arrest him.
And one really has to ask the question why the government was not able to arrest or even question him. This is Islamabad we're talking about. It's the capital of the country. The
population is over 1 million people. Jirga was a real public event.
It was at a big hotel. It was advertised widely. It was an open event.
Tariq Aziz was plainly visible to hundreds and hundreds of people. He talked with reporters. Everything about him that the authorities could have wanted to know about his location and about his recent activities were known to the United States.
So it would have been extremely easy for them to approach him, sit down and talk to him, or for that matter, put him in jail. But instead, the CIA chose to go and kill him without giving him the opportunity to give his side of whatever it is that they thought that he had done. There is no evidence there whatsoever. And they've given him no lawyers, there's no judge, and there's no jury.
Our preference is always to capture if we can, because we can gather intelligence. But a lot of the terrorist networks that target the United States, the most dangerous ones, operate in very remote regions, and it's very difficult to capture them.
But what we can discern from the pattern of strikes is that essentially Pakistan's been declared a no-capture zone that automatically capture's not considered feasible.
If you just look at the numbers, there have been dramatically more people killed in recent years than have been captured.
They've killed maybe 3,000 to 4,000 people in targeted killings, and they've captured a handful.
There are no CIA agents in Waziristan, so they rely on local people.
And this is where the fundamental wrong is, because these people are working for you for money.
And that reliance is utterly misplaced. And what you see in Tariq's case, and it just pains me to say this, that you know without any real room for dispute that there was someone in that room when we were having our Jirga, who was an informant for the U.S. intelligence services, and that person picked out Tariq. I can tell you as a matter of fact that Tariq was not an extremist. And the way you know what intelligence they relied on to kill someone is what they release immediately after the killing. And in that case, they said 4 militants were killed. And of course, we know that 2 kids were killed. That's how it happened.
I asked the CIA about the strike, and their response was, on that day, no child was killed. In fact, the adult males were supporting Al-Qaeda's facilitation network. So despite all of these technological assets and human assets, we're not there. We don't know. And I think there is a lot of room for error.
Killing Tariq was clearly breaking the law. In fact, it was further than that. It was just murder.
Tariq Aziz was one of almost 300 children killed. Why are these children being killed?
This is a targeted, focused effort at people who are on a list
of active terrorists.
The killing of Tariq Aziz has to call into question the credibility of the government's kill list methodology.
The vast majority of the strikes here are against people whose identities the government doesn't know.
We do not know where targeted killings are authorized to be used. We do not know the specific identities of people who have been killed.
The Constitution empowers the president to protect the nation from any imminent threat of attack.
So how can Tariq Aziz, a 16-year-old boy, possibly meet that definition of imminent threat?
The Justice Department has defined an imminent threat based not on whether the threat is specific and immediate, which is what imminent means.
So that people pose imminent threats regardless of whether they are actually engaged in any ongoing immediate attack against the United States.
We have a responsibility to defend this country, and that's what we're doing.
Killing Tariq hasn't made us any safer. It's taken away a young boy's life. It's destroyed a family and a community.
Under the interpretations we've heard from the administration and members of Congress, drone strikes could go on indefinitely against enemies that keep morphing into new enemies. But killing should be the exception, not the rule.
Tariq Aziz should never have died. The U.S. should not have been using military force to attack innocent civilians, let alone children.
I would question a policy that says it is legitimate and even sensible to assassinate a 16-year-old boy.
He was trying to be part of the constructive way forward.
Tariq wanted to do something to help. I think he felt that he had more to give, more to talk about, and more to understand. And the impact of Tariq's murder on my life has been huge. Made me reflect deeply and made me question a lot of things. He has now become a symbolic figure in innocent children that have been killed by drone strikes.
He was just a kid.
There's two guys in front, one guy in the rear. They're walking up this path, and the two guys in front are discussing. They're like, you can see them having an avid conversation. They've got something slung over their shoulders, which look to be weapons. Mountainous portions of Afghanistan are not so unsimilar from the mountainous regions of Montana. And seeing people with guns walking around the mountains of Afghanistan was like, well, people are walking with guns in the mountains of Montana. But as soon as we get eyes on them, it's like, immediately confirm door weapons, confirm your cleared target. So place the target at their feet and we get missiles away. Ends up getting all three of them. But the guy in the back, it ends up cutting his leg off above the knee and severing his femoral artery. And he's rolling around, he's holding it, and he's just like rolling around, but you can see like where his leg is missing and the blood is spurting out and landing on the ground, and it's cooling. It's hot, it's a hot pool of blood, and it's cooling. And we keep eyes on and watch the guy become the same color as the ground that he bled out on. I could almost see his facial expression. It was, I can almost see his mouth open and crying out. Maybe he cursed us, or maybe he asked Allah for forgiveness for us. Who knows what his last thoughts were, but it wasn't pretty, whatever it was. It was shock and trauma, and his ears were probably ringing, and he was bleeding out, and he was in agony. I didn't know how to react. No one teaches you how to react. They teach you how to do it. There's no... They ignore the reaction part. I wished I never contributed further to that.
There must be near certainty that no civilians will be killed or injured. The highest standard we can set.
vast majority of those killed in drone strikes, over 98%, have not been high-value targets.
The adoption of signature strikes make indiscriminate killing, you know, a policy.
What they end up with is what I described earlier, the signature strike.
And they move back to a greater reliance on these signature strikes.
A signature strike is a drone strike that isn't based on the identity of the target.
I obtained classified U.S. intelligence reports on drone strikes. What the documents reveal are the way that signature strikes are put together. And these are strikes against people who fit the signature of what the U.S. government says is a terrorist.
Maybe they are walking in and out of the compound with guns. Maybe they're getting in trucks and they're moving to the Afghan border.
And drone operators seated thousands of miles away from the area affected are looking at video feeds, assessing those video feeds, and based on that, making decisions about whether or not someone who's walking through the community is a suspected terrorist.
You conclude on the basis of the behavior that they are a terrorist, and you kill them.
In a number of cases that I looked at, the CIA wasn't sure who they were hitting.
The agency became convinced that it had gotten so good at watching from above that it could distinguish different groups. It could distinguish whether a terrorist leader was at a certain location.
But there is room for a lot of misunderstanding when you're doing something like conducting signature strikes.
A drone strike is only as good as the intelligence that is behind the actual strike.
Anyone who's worked in intelligence knows that intelligence doesn't, quote unquote, prove anything. It's not evidence.
So drones hit what they aim to hit. But if they're aimed at the wrong people, then civilians are killed.
Former U.S. Ambassador Cameron Munter had said that one man's combatant was another man's chump who went to a meeting.
When Leon Panetta was director of the CIA, somebody memorably said, if Leon sees a few guys doing jumping jacks on the ground, he thinks that's a terrorist training camp.
Classified documents suggest U.S. officials don't always know exactly how many or who they're killing.
They don't always have precise ID.
The apparent targeting of people whose identity is not known.
They may not be as precise as many U.S. officials claim.
As soon as those signature strikes begin, we start to see another steep escalation in civilian casualties. So that's what happens when signature strikes go wrong. Large numbers of people die because they don't know who's been killed in most of the drone strikes.
On March 17th, 2011, a jirga was held in Dadakel to resolve a dispute over a chromite mine.
If there is a feud getting out of hand, jirga will convene and everyone has a chance to speak. It really is a democracy, and that is a mechanism to make sure that there is stability in society.
In an open space in a bus depot in broad daylight, tribal elders informed the Pakistani military.
Brigadier Dogan was in command of the brigade on the border, so he is a key commander. The brigadier knew about the jirga 10 days in advance. His own army camp was 10 kilometers from the site of the jirga.
So this was an open, public event that pretty much everyone in the community and surrounding area knew about. So the jirga begins in the morning at about 10 o'clock, and after about 20 minutes or so, and debris and chaos.
It was a huge explosion, so people in the shop, in the nearby area, they rushed to the place.
On a single day, it's devastating for that community. It's devastating in terms of leadership. It's devastating in terms of the moral compass. And it's devastating in economic terms as well.
At the end of a series of drone strikes, it's feeding into the sense of no one is safe, nowhere is safe, nothing is safe. even a jirga, the most cherished, the most treasured institution of the tribal areas. So we cannot even sit down and resolve an issue. That is not safe anymore.
مش په وځي باندې جلګانه شکرلای سره په وځي دا ډېر نو ستای ویل وړای میر نشي سره کلای ځکه چې میر 24 ګنټه ډرونه مې شاټ
د پاپولیشن اند دیر بیسیک سنس اف سکیورټی اند بیسیک سنس اف لیوینګ ان دټ ایریا
او باقی دې
جون برنن ستود اپ اند سډ
نیرلی فور د پاست ایئر دیر هازنټ بین ا سنگل کولاترل ډیث بیکاز اف دی اکسپشنل پروفیشنسی precision of the capabilities that we've been able to develop.
High-level authorities tell the American public that there have been no civilian casualties.
They were presumably using this notion that any male of a certain age, roughly between 14 and 60, who is killed is automatically counted as a combatant.
The Vietnam body count as a metric was flawed. It did not really give you a measure of how successful you were being. In fact, it led you astray in assessing that. And the drone strikes are the same way. They're the wrong metric. Tell me how we're winning if every time we kill one, we create 10.
Strikes at Dathakel caused a significant negative reaction by Pakistani authorities and by the Pakistani people.
Anti-American sentiment in Pakistan reached greater heights.
That very large drone strike really upended U.S.-Pakistani relations.
I was a military guy for 25 years. I've done 7 wars. I'm not about being nice to the enemy. But the blowback and the aspect of political destabilization, those things ultimately do make us less safe.
The growing public outcry appears to have at least compelled the country's top political and military leadership to publicly denounce U.S. drone attacks.
Violence is not the only solution. You have a recourse available. You can go to Pakistani courts to take up this matter legally.
My critics, they were saying, how can you do drone litigation? Oh, there's no jurisdiction in tribal areas. There were so many issues and there were so many objections. It's a common joke in Pakistan that grandfather starts a litigation and then the grandson actually gets to hear the verdict in that case. But I decided to file the Peshawar High Court litigation because the 17th March 2011 strike was a typical example of signature strikes and what's wrong with them. But during the process, the most interesting thing was that in the last 5 years, more than 1,400 civilian Pakistanis have been killed in drone strikes.
A Pakistani court has declared U.S. drone attacks in the country a war crime.
In a landmark judgment, the High Court described the attacks as a blatant violation of Pakistan's sovereignty.
The court ruled that the practice was illegal.
A court in Pakistan has ruled U.S. drone strikes on Pakistani territory are illegal and should be stopped.
CIA officials are committing the offense of murder. It's not a demand of Pakistan anymore that drone strikes should stop. It's their legal obligation that drones need to stop. If you really want to do something and if you really want to get justice for people who have been denied justice, you can achieve that.
The human rights organization Reprieve has filed a lawsuit against the UK for its role in drone strikes.
Barack Obama is facing demands in court to reveal more about the U.S. drone program.
The ACLU filed a lawsuit on behalf of families of 3 Americans killed in drone strikes.
Drone victims accused John A. Rizzo of conspiracy to wage a war of aggression, to commit murder, and crimes against humanity.
Can you take the drones out of the hands of the CIA?
Ma'am, let me finish.
People on the ground are saying, where is the accountability for this? It's unleashed a global citizen movement.
We don't feel that our government should be killing people without trial, without conviction.
It's a very, very wicked thing to do.
This demonstration, it's for Obama, for him to transform the current policies of the United States.
Thousands gathered on Monday to condemn the recent U.S. drone attack.
Protesters in Atlanta say drones are dangerous and they want them banned.
Drone strikes are acts of terrorism.
In San Diego, there are regular protests outside General Atomics.
Killer drones have no shame.
War is not a video game.
We need to stop these killer drones from leading us into a world of chaos and lawlessness.
You lawmakers, you senators, enough is enough.
I don't think the United States has the authority to be going around the world deciding who to assassinate.
Coming to work, told that they found a high-profile dude hanging out. We're told that they have intel that this guy is there and they're going to strike him. And so, like, if this guy's a high-ranking bad guy, like, why not? There was a lot of activity there earlier that day. Pretty much everyone's left. But the intel that the guy is still there. And so we fired. And then 6 seconds before missile impact, something runs around the building. When I brought that up, The screener who disseminated the video feed said that it was a dog. But I don't think that he ever mentioned a dog the entire evening of them monitoring. I mean, I was pretty much brand spanking new at this. I'd only been doing it a couple months. So who was I to question? I doubt myself at times. Like, maybe it was, I was seeing things, but ultimately, I believe there was a child killed, and that burden is placed on me. Doing this, I had to really think about why was I here? Why am I doing this? I was pretty religious at the time, and I went and talked to the chaplain, and under the orders of my commander, actually, and I got nothing out of it. He was just basically like, "It's God's plan. It's God's fucking plan for people to die." Like, that, I don't want to hear that shit. I didn't feel like I was a part of anything good or wholesome or healthy or contributing to the greater good. I felt like I was destroying myself. I was taking who I pictured myself to be in my head and chopping it down. And breaking it down, taking a sledgehammer to it. And it crumbled.
Well, these droners are the kind of people that run this corrupt criminal government. They have no, I'm not going to say a right, because there is no such thing, but for them to be occupying and killing leaders in the Middle East, invading Iraq and under false pretenses and all that kind of stuff. And like they say, every time they bomb the shit out of those people, they're going to have 10 or 20 young ones come up with willing to strap on C4. And this excuse that we got to kill these people over there because they're coming over here. Well, yeah, the reason if they come over here, they're going to come over here is because of what we've done over there in our name. Now, I am a racist. I am a racial separatist. That does not mean that I support any kind of this predatory capitalist war machine. In fact, I hate it. I hate the Pentagon. I hate the federal offices, and I hate the Congress. I hate the pretty much the big banks in New York and places like that, and the city of London. I hate them. They say, "Oh, you're a hater." Yeah, I am a hater. Yeah. But I'm, as a racial separatist, we got to understand that we're included in this. When they blame United States, they blame us too. And even though a lot of the right wing deserves to be accused like that, because I was around the right wing long enough to know there's plenty of people out there who just say, kill them because they're not white. Well, that's not what my job is. My job is to promote the welfare of the white race and as separatism and to work things out with other races, if we can at all. I'm not a pacifist. But when somebody like Dennis Mahan goes to prison for 40 years for allegedly sending a little teeny explosive device that didn't even blow up a building, it just it hurt a black's hand, which he recovered fine. And like that, when this government is murdering people all over the goddamn place, and almost nobody in prison in the United States today has ever done anything as bad as Obama has done, and Bush has done, and Clinton has done, and all the way back, Nixon and all of them, and Johnson and all of them. So we got to make it clear to people what we are and what we're not. And in the right wing, they're not making it clear enough at all. Too many of those people talk about, you know, we're white racists, but we're going to kill everybody that's not white. Well, it's all coming back on this country, and I've been telling you for a long time, it's all coming back. And if I was a young Arab in the Middle East and saw what the U.S. government criminals have been doing to my country, guess who I would join up with? There's no question about it. Now, the other thing is, too, if you don't care about that, those old people over there, I want to tell you, this same government will do the exact same thing to you if you get out of line. If there is a popular uprising in this country of resistance to the criminal regime, they will use drones on you without even hedging a bet. And they're not going to, everybody worry about coming for your guns. No, they're coming for your lives. Forget the guns. They're just going to come for your lives and drone you out or something like that. Anyhow, I hope you get this and understand this message. Because if you don't, you're going to become a victim of this rotten, corrupt Judeo-Christian system. And all those goody-two-shoes Christians sitting around in their goddamn churches praying for the soldiers over there. In other words, praying for the drones, praying for the bombers, bombing everybody and everything else, because God is with us. I'll be back tomorrow on Tears Day, and in the meantime, five words. I was watching a miniseries last night to where a guy gets sort of sucked in to a crime he didn't commit, but the dumb bastard just keeps talking, just keeps digging himself a grave. And then he's saying, well, I can't get a good attorney. You don't need a good attorney. You just need to keep your mouth shut. Don't talk. How much of an attorney do you need for that? See you tomorrow.
Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line, a flag on his wheelchair. chair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. The empty storefronts around the square, there's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. Man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd gets thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. Cracks. So let's Let them eat jelly beans, let them eat cake, let them eat shit, whatever it takes. They can join the Air Force or join the Corps if they can't make it here anymore. What we got, and if the president wants to admit it or not, you can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo, look us in the eye, call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains. It's done closed down, along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here.